Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Spencer Robinson, who is currently a talent and literary manager, a former blackjack team player, who was also bass player for the Lords of Altamont classic rock band. Spencer Robinson, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks, guys. I'm happy to be here.
Although we will play one of your new songs called Tunica, based on being a blackjack player in Mississippi, we'll start with your blackjack career.
Sounds good.
How did you get started playing blackjack?
It was actually really a fluke. I mean, I was in my early 20s, and I moved into a new apartment. And basically, one of my neighbors, who was an actor, and he was just gone all the time. And I always assumed that he was just shooting commercials or shooting something, you know. And he had money, and he was, you know, doing fine. And one day, he kind of confided in me and told me, "Look, I am an actor, and I do that, but I also make money playing on a blackjack team." And, you know, I knew what card counting was from watching movies, you know, obviously like Rain Man, the ones that everyone always refers to. But I didn't know the ins and outs of it, and I didn't know anything about a blackjack team. So he basically told me what it was. He trusted me, and he knew that I you know, always needed money because I was always so broke. And he said, "Look, if you want to learn how to do this, I'll teach you. Are you interested?" And I said, "Absolutely." And basically,
what year was that?
Early 2000s, so probably like, I don't know, 2002, 2003, somewhere around there.
How did that process start? I mean, did he give you a book and say, you know, go learn basic strategy, or?
No, he you know, it's funny. He kind of threw me into the counting part first, and I think that he left it up to me to learn basic strategy, which was fine. You know, as for the, you know, that's definitely the easier part to learn. So, you know, he just brought over a deck of cards. He was my neighbor. We live next door. He brought over a deck of cards and showed me how to just start kind of running counting drills. So I would take a deck of cards. You know, I'm sure you guys have done it, and your listeners probably too. You remove two or three cards, and you just, you know, count the deck, and then you check your math at the end. I started with that. And
you were using the high-low, or?
I was using the high-low, and eventually we could talk about it at some point. I went on and used KO as well, but at that point I was using all high-low, and he just started with just, you know, just the plus and minus system, and later on we got into getting the true count and actually playing.
And now this was a really, really large team, an offshoot of the MIT team. Josh Axelrod in his book referred to them as Mossad. But I think most of our listeners would know them as the Greeks.
Of course.
So what was the checkout process, or when were you introduced to the team as a potential member?
Well, so I think for about 2.5-3 months, I worked with my neighbor on learning, you know, how it all worked, and he really gave me a lot of stories and told me basically what to expect. So when I finally went out to Las Vegas to test and try to be on this team, I was very ready mentally. I knew exactly what to expect as far as, you know, the amount of people that would be there and how the kind of the high pressure and everything. That being said, I didn't really realize that I would be failing the test for 3 days, which is what happened. So I got out there, and it was a table test, and basically you played two hands, and you had to play basic strategy on both hands. There was no betting in the initial test, which made it, you know, actually pretty easy looking back. But you played basic strategy on both hands, and you counted a shoe, and there were six shoes. And basically you could be off, I think, a total of two numbers total through the whole test. You know, so you couldn't really be off very much. You had to be almost spot on. And if you made any basic strategy errors, it was an automatic fail.
Yeah.
And so I did that. And, you know, I was very nervous sitting down just because, you know, it's a new thing. And I also didn't realize that they were going to throw distractions at me while I was doing it. You know, anything from having a conversation to throwing chips at me to knocking over drinks, whatever it was a lot of distraction. And like I said, I failed for 3 days. 3 days straight, testing all day and failing all day.
Wow.
And then eventually I passed, and I started playing that night, which was really exciting.
Oh, wow.
They must have seen potential in you to let you keep going after failing 3 days.
Usually, I like to think so.
Badly, if you fail badly, they go, well, we really thank you for coming in, but, you know, why don't you take up bowling or something?
Sure. I like to think so. I mean, you know, it helped that I had a neighbor that I knew well. He'd vouch for me, so I think they trusted me, which is a big part of it, as everyone can guess. You know, you're handling money, and you have to have trust in somebody. But also, you know, I talked to them. I told them how interested I was in doing it. I told them what I had done to train. I think they could tell that I was very committed to making this a real thing and really getting involved in it. And I think that they saw that I was able to do it, but I was nervous. And I knew the mechanics of it. I knew, you know, basic strategy, backward and forward. Like, I knew all the things. I just had to get it to all click so that I could do it second nature, and that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't so stunted, and it wasn't a nervous wreck, and I wasn't shaking, and all those things. And after failing for 3 days, by the end of it, I was pretty good.
Also, I think they realized that your experience was probably closer to the norm than, you know, everybody thinks they count better than they actually do. And I'll bet they had a lot of people that came in and tested, and it would be a very rare bird that would pass the test right away.
I'm sure. You know, I wasn't there for a lot of the testing for people when it came to that first level, but I did, so I didn't get a chance to see, you know, how I stacked up against them. But they didn't seem really shocked that I was failing, so that made me feel okay. Like, I'm like, okay, well, they know that this is hard too, because they've all done it, they can do it, so I guess they're going to stick with me, and I'm just going to keep working on it. And, you know, I ran drills, and I did everything that they said, and I really tried to ask, hey, what can I do to get better at this? I'm not passing. What's happening? What can I do? And they work with me, and then eventually I passed. And when I passed, it felt great. It was really, really exciting.
So what was the first job they gave you going out, you know, on that first play? What was your role?
I was a spotter. So basically, I went in, you know, I played table minimum. I counted the cards, and when I got a count, I would have to stall the game and use signals to call over. If it was a big bettor that actually knew how to count, call them over and pass them the count. If it was a big player that did not know how to count, I'd have to call them over and call somebody over that could control them and pass the count. And then I would either leave or stay depending on the circumstances. But it was, you know, looking back, it's a pretty easy job, you know, and it's one of those things that it's such an easy test to pass years later when I had to do it again for a different count. But that first time, it was really, really tough. And when I got out there, it was very, very exciting to kind of just be the first person out there finding those shoes.
Yeah, that seems like a lot of extra manpower if you also have to call over someone as a controller to call the plays. But I guess because it was you were so new, they didn't want you actually calling the plays.
Well, yes and no. I mean, for a few reasons. First of all, I wasn't trained as a controller. You know, as far as being able to tell the BP when to deviate from basic strategy, and there's a whole other level of stuff that comes along with that that I was not trained to do yet. But, you know, as anybody who's done this knows, you burn through the big players pretty quickly, or that you can, you know, as far as them getting blown out. You know, so getting a new player in that can bet the money that doesn't know how to count is a lot faster than getting one that does.
So, oh, absolutely, yeah.
Right, so
but I would think that most of the spotters, I would think, would ultimately learn to control also.
Right. Absolutely, and eventually, of course, I did, and I went on to do a lot more. But, yeah, but that first, just getting a body in there to find the counts, just because we were playing in such a huge force when we were in Las Vegas and in a smaller level, Atlantic City, but definitely in Las Vegas. So you needed a lot of bodies because there are so many casinos to play.
Right, right. Now, as you say, one of the things that I thought was really unusual about that team was not only did they come in, you know, betting two or three hands of 10,000 on these call-in plays.
It was guns blazing, always.
Guns blazing, yes, but they would give up their name and cash out the chips. And, I mean, I can't imagine a BP would last more than one play. Because he would go and their rule was, and I get this, when you're dealing with that much money, like, we always will, have the CTR filed. We always will give up our real name, real ID, no shenanigans, because that is a way to get a lot of extra problems when you start,
right.
You know, people start using fake IDs and stuff. So, but it means the casino has your real name after the very first play.
Absolutely.
Was that it? I mean, basically, BP's got to make one play and they were done, or?
No, I mean, look, you know, it wasn't quite that bad, you know, because although the casinos obviously communicate, the name wouldn't get around as fast as maybe it would now. You know, I mean, look, when I was playing blackjack, if they were suspicious of a play, they were still pulling out loose leaves full of fax photos to look for you. You know, there was no email in the pit for them to look for pictures. So we're dealing with a little bit of a simpler time when it comes to technology, and the names didn't get around quite as fast as I'm sure they do now. You know, so the PCs would last a bit, and, you know, maybe if you get burned in Vegas, you wouldn't go back to Vegas for a couple months. You go play somewhere else. You know, and it wouldn't always follow you, and now eventually it started to follow you places. But as far as, like, doing a CTR and using your real name, this team, we were dealing with a lot of money, obviously, and we wanted to do everything as fully legal as possible. I mean, really above board. You know, taxes were paid. It was all done legal because you don't want to do anything illegal and risk having the money taken away or having any kind of police activity. If everything you're doing is legal, then nobody can ever call the police on you.
Well, in theory, anyway. I mean, certainly there have been a lot of people who are just counting cards that got backroomed and, you know,
sure, but,
arrested
but
trespass or whatever.
Security is different than police. But, yeah, theoretically, exactly. I mean, the idea was to minimize any of that kind of stuff so that if it ever came up, nothing illegal is being done. And I will say that being on that team, besides all the amazing stuff that I learned, like the technical aspect of counting and odds and all that kind of stuff, being taught what the law actually was – came in so handy for me when people tried to backroom me and people tried to do things that I knew they couldn't do. And I was able to kind of stick to my guns and be like, no, I'm not going with you. And this is why. You can't touch me. And this is why, you know? And so when those things came up, I was never afraid of a security guard. Because I know that they actually had no power.
Yeah. Often you probably knew the law far better than they did.
Sure. You know, and that's one of the things that I was always told by the people on the team. It's like, look, they may not even know why they're coming to kick you out. They may just say, hey, that person has done a bad thing. Get them out of here. Okay. You know, they don't know. And I've dealt with some security guards that have overstepped. And, you know, you got to slap them back a little bit, not physically, but, you know, verbally. And they usually slap back into place.
Yeah.
You indicated when you were telling about your first night when you were a spotter that part of your job as being a spotter is to stall the table until you can get the right people there.
Sure.
What was the longest you ever had to stall a table, and how did you do it?
It's one of my favorite stories to tell about playing on the team, because it's one of those times when everything worked exactly as it's supposed to. And look, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes you lose. Sometimes you miss out on, you know, whatever. But this time, we were playing at the Mandalay Bay, and there was a BP and then two controllers in the car. And we parked, and we threw a call into the other people in Vegas. We're like, hey, come down and meet us. We're going to get started in the pit. Just come in the mid-session, you know, and filter in, and it'll be fine. So we went, and we were playing the $100 minimum tables at the Mandalay Bay. And, you know, I sat down and I started flat betting 100 and, you know, just counting the cards. And, you know, within a few minutes, I got a count. I'm like, great. So I look up now and I see my BP sitting at a table playing, being controlled by the other controller. Which, okay, so, I know I got to stall, no big deal, right? So I start stalling. I put my hand over the betting square because, you know, that gets everyone's attention and stops the dealer from dealing. And I start asking questions. I mean, you know, dumb questions. Yeah, you know, what are the good restaurants in the Mandalay Bay? What are the good clubs? You know, where can I get a steak? Where can I get this? And then when they started getting tired of me asking these really dumb questions, I started asking questions about blackjack. How does surrender work? What's insurance? I don't get it. Explain it to me. That still doesn't make sense. Explain it to me again. You know, and I stalled for about 5 or 6 minutes. It was a long time. But I will say that I let no cards go. And when the BP finally got over there, I called them in. And it was, like I said, it's the way that it works in a movie. He sat down, he started betting. I kept betting, flat betting the 100 just because it would have been awkward at that point for me to get up and run away. And the dealer busted every hand. I mean, literally every hand. We made about $38,000 in that, like, 15 minutes we played. And we ended up leaving with no attention at all. They didn't even ask him for his rating card until he was up 15 or 16 grand. And we got out of there, and we called everybody else, said, you know what, just go back. We actually already made a bunch of money and got out, and we'll move on to the next one. And it's one of those times when things work exactly as they're supposed to. Like I said, the way they do in a movie when they have a car counting scene, and, like, everybody wins, and it's easy, and no one gets thrown out.
Right.
Well, that's the way it is in the early part of the movie, before the clock thickens, and the extra things get in there to make it more You got to get some tension in the movie.
Always, yeah, of course. Yeah, but it was like, it's a beautiful thing, as we always say. You know, it was really nice to get in there. And I mean, like I said, they barely noticed the guy. He was betting, he was making money, and no one seemed to care at all. And that so rarely happened.
Yeah, okay. Actually, there was a period back then when Mandalay really just did not sweat the money. And, you know, it was a really great place to play back then.
It was, and it was funny. I remember I called them once. I was going into Vegas for the weekend with some friends, just for, you know, and I wasn't even planning on really playing because it wasn't a team weekend. And, you know, if I was going to go and play for a smaller bit of money under the same name, that would look weird. So I just called Mandalay Bay. I'm like, look, I'm coming there. I'm bringing my girlfriend. I'm bringing some friends. I'm probably not gonna be gambling, but look, I've played a lot of money there. I want some comps. And they gave me rooms. They gave me tickets to see Prince and a bunch of other free meals and things like that. And I just had a party weekend, you know, just on the Mandalay Bay. And they were really okay with the whole thing. No issue at all.
Yeah.
Which surprised me, but it was nice, you know.
Yeah, I bet it was. Now, you were a bona fide rock and roll musician.
I was and am, absolutely.
And so I would think that would be a hell of a good disguise at a blackjack table.
It was really good. And it was great.
So tell us about how did you use that to explain why you had money and why you could fly in and stuff and why you had
hair
or whatever else.
All of those things, actually. It's funny. Like, in Las Vegas, there's so many different kinds of people there. No one really questions why someone's there. It's Las Vegas. People go there to, you know, to hang out, party, and do whatever. But when you start to get to places like Philadelphia, Mississippi, or Biloxi or Gulfport, like all these places that really it's a lot of locals and not a lot of, you know, tourists are coming there from Los Angeles or from New York or wherever else to go gamble. So I would just always say that I was on tour. I would always say my band was playing in a nearby city. And the band that I was in, we did very well in Europe, and I toured a lot in Europe to play for big crowds. But no one really knew who we were in the U.S. on a big level. So even if I gave them the band name, they could look it up and see that I was a real band if they really wanted to, but it isn't the kind of thing that you say, like, oh, the Rolling Stones are in town, everybody knows. You know what I mean? So I could be in town and they would never know it if I was playing music. So if they wanted to know, you know, what I was doing in town, I would say, oh, I just got a record deal and I got some money to blow and I'm here in Philadelphia, Mississippi playing at your little tiny casino. You know, so it was really good for things like that.
Did you ever try, you know, hiring some groupies to come in while you were playing just to boost your image?
I did not do that, but I did play the Imperial Palace, which I guess is gone now. But when it was there, I did take somebody there to play as like a bandmate, and they actually wore a disguise. I went as myself because I looked like I was in a band, and they wore a disguise and wore a wig and the whole thing, and they came as my bandmate and did shuffle tracking at the table with me. So I didn't do groupies, but I definitely had a fake bandmate go play a few times with me. And actually won, considering it was a $500 max there, I won about 50 grand over the course of two or three trips at that casino, which I thought was decent for that place. You know, and they actually, it was really funny. They loved me and they would, you know, close a table for me. So it was a really nice environment to play in. And then when they realized what was happening, they were so mad. Like, yeah, they really, like, I mean, the death stares that I got from those guys that had been so nice to me was so funny.
Yeah. You know, I actually was in Cannes one year for the Cannes Film Festival and was playing blackjack, and I ran into a friend who was a journalist, and I had him come into the casino and ask to photograph me and ask if he could interview me, and it worked out perfectly because I happened to be talking to the casino manager when he got there. I had already been playing. I was already winning a bunch of money. And he comes up right in the middle of our conversation and says, oh, do you mind if I get your picture? And, you know, can I get an interview? And the casino manager just totally ate it up. Yeah.
That's so great. That's funny. So, you know, I mentioned before, the band that I was in, we toured in Europe a lot. Like, you know, I played some shows in the U.S., but I'd go to Europe three times a year and play these big tours, and I played for these big crowds, and it was great. And we were taking the ferry from France over to England at one point, and there were casinos in this town, and I thought about going to play there, but it dawned on me that I didn't really know the law. And I actually was a little bit worried about what could happen. I mostly didn't want to get risked, like, missing the shows that I was you know, playing on this tour if I got thrown in some kind of a French blackjack jail, which is probably not really a thing. But I was actually worried. So it's cool that you got a chance to do that, because I don't actually know what the laws are about counting are in France.
Well, actually, I can't imagine better publicity for your band than that. But
that's fair. Very fair.
The laws are fine. I mean, there's no legal problem with counting cards anywhere that I'm aware of in Europe. Just like the U.S., you can get backed off and
right.
And,
yeah, it's so funny. Well, sorry.
Well, Richard said in a recent show there are casinos in London that it's against their club rules to count cards there, and so if you go in and lose, then everything's fine. But if you go in and win, they remind you of those rules and sometimes forget to pay you.
Oh, that's so dirty.
Which makes it a tough game to beat.
So dirty.
Yeah, that's a more recent problem. I one time, many, many years ago, we were using a shuffle tracking computer back when those were legal.
Oh,
and
wow,
we were in a casino in England, and we won enough where they didn't have enough money to pay us. And
wow.
The next day, we decided to take the chips back to our hotel with us, and they said they would go to the bank the next day and have the money for us to cash out. And when we went back the next day, Scotland Yard was there waiting for us.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah. But, you know, we did get paid, and there was no problem, but we couldn't walk into another casino in England at that
wow.
point because
– That's amazing.
It was pretty crazy.
It's amazing. Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I first got on the team and I was, you know, I just learned how to count and I was feeling really – energized and excited about the idea of counting. Around the same time, I got invited to go to like an after hours bar in Los Angeles. And, you know, it's one of those places that opens at 2 a.m. on the weekends. And, you know, it was all very hush hush. And I thought it was kind of cool. And when I went into this bar, they served alcohol all night, which I was like, okay, that's kind of cool because places close eventually in LA. But then they served like hard drugs on a pedestal. It was like a real true speakeasy with drugs and alcohol. And
That's a real rock star party.
Right, and it was crazy, but they had a blackjack table in there and a roulette wheel as well. And a friend of mine, one of my best friends who knew that I was on this team, he was like, are you going to play blackjack? And for a second, I'm like, wow, playing, counting cards at an underground, you know, an underground club and winning somebody here would be great. And then I realized that the laws definitely did not apply there, and I started getting really worried about what would happen if they actually caught me in that place counting cards. So I opted not to do it there just because I was really worried about getting my hands broken. Or worse.
You know, I got a call like that one time in Los Angeles. One of my closest friends called me and said, they're having this big party next door. It's this family of Filipinos, and there's an entire cow on a spit in the driveway, and they're playing blackjack in the house.
Wow.
And you should get over here. So I went over there, and I went inside, and you know, I was the only Caucasian there, and here is this blackjack game. The guy's dealing four decks, and he has one of those shuffling machines like you get in the drugstore where you
right.
put the cards on both sides, and there's a little plastic tray.
Sure.
And he was dealing about 3.5 decks out of four, and then he would take the cards out, put them in that machine, and riffle it one time and put them back in the shoe.
Sounds like a dream table. It sounds great.
Yeah, but I just took one look and I thought, you know, for the same reasons you didn't play in that club, I thought I may not get out of here alive, you know.
Yeah, if you're gonna do something like counting, and it's gonna be at a place where you don't know that anyone there knows about it or understands, you know, that what you're doing isn't like elite, whatever. You know, you don't want to risk it. I think you're probably better off not getting yourself into a situation like that.
Yeah. Yep. Yes. You know, now as it turned out, I ended up marrying the girl who lived in that house, and and later went out with her brother, who was the dealer of that game, and we continued to deal those games, although
that's
I shuffled the cards a little better
of course.
After
so
that.
Funny.
Now, every blackjack player gets backed off multiple times.
Many times, unfortunately.
Were any of your backoffs particularly memorable?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I've had every kind of backoff you could possibly imagine for the most part. You know, I've had Mr. Robinson, you can hang out here, but no 21, which is very funny because they know you're going to leave. But there's one that I always tell a story about. I was at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and we had started this little small offshoot team within the Greeks where we were doing the KO count because it was easier to get people ramped up quickly. To learn the count. And at this point, I was a pretty known blackjack player, and I couldn't really play that many places. So I would just take out players that kind of lead their sessions. And I would, sit at the roulette wheel or sit in the bar, and I would just, play a little bit here and there, but try to kind of remain in the background and just oversee things. And we were playing at Caesars, and the entire play got blown. I mean, they got all of us at once. And, it happens. It's frustrating, but whatever. And I had a little bit of money. I just played a little bit, and I was heading over to the cage to cash out the little bit of money that I had won, and I got surrounded by 8 security guards. And I was like, oh, boy. And, I'd been asked to go to the back room before, but this was pretty aggressive, and they said to me, you're going to the back room. And I said, no, I'm not. Come on, guys, this is silly. And they're going to the back room right now. And I'm like, look, I'm not going with you. And all this time, I know the rules. I know that you keep your hands at your side because there's no sound on the video and you don't want to flare your arms and make it look like you're going to hit anybody and all that stuff that I learned, And so I just start talking. And I'm like, look, guys, this is so silly. Just let me leave and we're done with this whole thing. And one of the guys said, get his ID. And they tried to grab my wallet out of my pocket. And I kind of turned around real fast and I said, now you guys know you can't touch me. Like, I know that you know that. And they got a little more angry and they said, look, you're going to the back room. And I go, why? They said, prostitution. And I said, I don't think that's the reason why. I don't think that you think that's the reason why. And basically they said to me, they were like, well, if you want to leave, push past us. Which, is fairly savvy, I guess, because knowing that if I push past them, it's assault. And I know that because the people on this team taught me that you can't push a security guard. So finally, after, so much time of just trying everything I could to convince them that they needed to leave, I pulled my cell phone out and I said, look, I'm calling the cops now. I've been kidnapped, and I'm going to call them, and I'm going to get you all arrested. And they parted like the Red Sea. And as I walked toward the door, they actually followed me toward the door. And as I walked out the door, they gave me one last push in my back. They like pushed me out the front door, which was silly, yes, but it was all funny, fine. But I guess for them, it was kind of getting that last little nudge in. And it was one of those things that they wanted me to go to the back room for, probably just to get a better photo of me or to get me to sign the no trespassing act or whatever it was. But I wasn't gonna go. And eventually, they realized that I wasn't gonna go. And that's one of those things that I'd seen people kind of fail at before when they would get really scared by security guards and they would just go voluntarily to the back room. And I'd said early on that was never going to happen because I knew that they couldn't hurt me. I knew they weren't going to hit me on camera in those casinos. That was never going to happen. There was no way that the corporation that owns these casinos is going to beat somebody up on the floor. So as long as I kept remembering that, I knew that I was never going to be forced to do anything crazy in these casinos that I didn't want to do.
Yeah. Although I do have a friend who was beaten up on the floor at Mandalay Bay.
Really? I guess maybe it's better that I was so ignorant to the fact that it could happen. I assume that would never happen because they're on camera. But I guess people do lose their minds and do stuff.
Well, yeah, and obviously it's not the corporate policy, and the guys at the top would be aghast or were aghast when they found out what the idiot security guards had done.
It'd be a really funny corporate policy if it actually was. It'd be a great line in like the corporate bylines. Beat up anybody you want.
Yeah. We've had a lot of former online poker players on this show, including one of the co-hosts. Spencer, were you an online blackjack player, and did you find those games beatable?
Yeah, it's actually funny. At one point, and this is not something that I discovered, people on the team discovered that, when those internet casinos really started popping up in droves, they would offer bonuses. And what they would do is they would say, hey, you know, you've joined our casino and you deposit, you know, say $100 into your casino account, we'll match it with $100. So now you got $200, and which is great. But of course, you couldn't then cash it out because that would be free money. They would say, now you have to pay, you have to play, you know, 10 times your account in dollars, and then you can cash out whatever left. So then you got to, you know, play $2,000 worth of, you know, any game you want in our casino. And what we realized, or someone on the team realized, is that mathematically, if you bet, you know, a dollar a hand, you're only expected to lose, you know, X amount. You know, your edge is not that, your disadvantage is not that small. So even at the end of betting, you know, $2,000 at a dollar a hand, you may have $160 left. You've now made $60. And it seems like a really kind of a lot to go through for that small amount of money. But we started doing it with every online casino. And I was doing it, you know, every casino, I signed up for every one of them, and I put money into every one of them, and I paid my, you know, my initial whatever it was, and I cashed out the money. And I made about 25 or 30 grand doing that and over the course of about a half a year, which is, you know, it's legitimate money. And it's legitimate money you can make while sitting at home in front of your computer. So it's one of those things that I would just do in my free time. I would just sit there, and I would just have like a little counter, so I kept track of what I played, so I would never play too much. You know, I would play the exact amount of money I needed to play. And then I cashed out, and you could do it once per casino because there's only a sign-up bonus one time. And eventually they got hip to it, and they started calling us promotion abusers, which we were. I abused the hell out of every promotion and made a bunch of money doing it. And it was great for a while, and then it went away. But it was a really cool thing to do just while you were sitting at home waiting for the next blackjack trip or waiting for lunch or waiting for whatever. You know, it was great.
Yeah, I agree. And I've said on the air numerous times, it was – by far the most lucrative gambling endeavor that I've ever been involved with. You know, I was doing it at a much bigger level than what you're talking,
sure.
But it was a gold mine when it was there.
And I did it at a bigger level at some point too. I didn't do it, like, there was people that I knew that were making very, very big deposits, and I didn't have as much cash lying around to do that kind of thing. But, you know, it was great. It was really nice to be able to make extra money in between playing. And I played a little bit of online poker here and there, but I wasn't great at it. I was, you know, I was fine and made a little money here and there. And for me, I was, you know, I had left my job and just wanted to play music and play blackjack. So if I was in between blackjack trips and I was just playing gigs at home or I wasn't on tour or whatever it was, I wanted to make some extra money. It's like, why not? I had free time, and there's a way to do it. It was actually really cool. It was a really great and, like I said, very lucrative way to pass the time. And really fun. Like, it was so silly that it actually worked, but it did.
Yeah. Now, do you did you have as you say, back then the communication was nowhere near as good as it is today.
Right.
But did you have this strange balance of being both public and private and trying to – like currently I still play, but I'm also a public figure.
Right.
But I don't – so I try to keep my face out of the public – you know, so that
sure.
I can still play anonymously. I mean, did you have those issues?
Well, you know, I'm talking about blackjack with you guys now, and I've talked about it in a couple of other forums just recently. But back then, I never talked about it. You know, I'd be in a band, and I do interviews for the band that I was in, and I never brought it up. You know, it's one of those things that you know, my close friends and family knew that I was doing it, but that was it. You know, I just never discussed it. So if I was publicly anywhere for playing music, that only helped for me being a blackjack player. You know,
right,
it's one of those
right.
things that, you know, unless I didn't want them to know my name, but I wasn't in a band that was so big that my name was like, you know, a household name. You know, maybe some people in France knew who I was, but nobody in Tunica knew who I was. You know, so it's like, you know, no one was ever going to make the connection that I was a professional blackjack player. If anything, they would have heard the band that I was in, and that's about it. So it ended up not really being an issue for me. And now I don't play blackjack anymore professionally, so I don't mind talking about it now.
Well, do you play at all? You say you don't play professionally, but, you know, I mean, that's an itch that comes back often for a lot of us.
Absolutely. And, yeah, and if I have a reason to go to Las Vegas, for sure I will, you know, I'll play. But I'll play on a smaller scale, and I'll play, you know, and of course I count because I can't play and not count. You know, and I usually do fairly well, but I'm not betting huge amounts of money anymore. It's actually funny. I went to Las Vegas for fun once, and I was playing actually at the Imperial Palace because I was staying right near there, and I just wandered in there to their poker room, and I was playing poker. I was just playing, you know, like no limit, but like, you know, like a $40 buy-in, like low no limit, you know, hold'em. And I got backed off playing poker at the Imperial Palace. It took them about 2 hours of me playing, but they finally realized who I was, and they threw me out, which I thought was really funny. But, you know, they did not like me there.
They just have no sense of humor, those people.
No, well, I mean, I remember when they threw me out, I said, really? I said, but it's poker. They go, we know. I go, but it's poker. And they go, yeah, you're leaving. I'm like, oh, okay, fair enough. I mean, what am I going to say? I'm not going to argue. I just thought it was so funny.
Yeah. Well, and it's crazy because you're not winning money from them. They're earning money from you if you play poker there.
It's absurd. I mean, like, people are – you guys know, casinos, they get really kind of testy. You know, they get pissy, they get angry, and, you know, it's a really weird thing. I mean, I've had some people that you feel like they're throwing you out because that's their job, but they're like, they're kind of cool about it in the sense that they're like, look, man, you know, you're done here. Just move on to the next place. Like, I can appreciate that. They're doing their job. It's a symbiotic relationship. I get it. But when people get really angry, like, I've been chased by security guards, and then I realized that early on, like, I'd be running from security. I'm like, wait, why am I running? They can't do anything to me. I remember once I got chased out of Harrah's on the Strip in Las Vegas, and I hid in the Margaritaville restaurant next door, the Jimmy Buffett restaurant. And after about 10 minutes of hiding, I'm like, wait, why am I hiding? The security guard followed me out of the casino into a restaurant next door, and I'm hiding like a kid playing hide-and-seek in a restaurant, and really felt like an idiot because they can't do anything to me, you know? But it's this really, really weird thing when you see a person with some kind of authority coming after you, your first thing is to get away. So I eventually learned that they can't do anything, and you just let them come to you, and they hassle you for a minute, and then they go away.
Yeah. You know, it's been a problem for a lot of players because they want to play in the World Series of Poker, and, you know, Caesars won't let them play because they've been 86th from blackjack. And so, which, again, they're just, you know, shooting themselves in the foot because it's just profit to allow people to play in the poker tournament. But
it's really weird.
I feel like
somewhere along the way, and look, this may be because of things like Bringing Down the House and the movie 21, and because it became, you know, at one point everyone was like, oh, counting cards, nobody can count cards unless you're a genius or unless you're autistic, like because of Rain Man. That's, you know, that was the general consensus by most people is that nobody can do it. Or, you know, you can't count a six-deck shoe. Like, there's all that kind of stuff that we've all heard before. And with blowing the lid open with all the television shows and the movies and all that kind of stuff and the documentaries, I think that it made people realize that it wasn't quite as difficult to learn how to do it as everyone thought, and that probably freaked the casinos out quite a bit. Because all of a sudden, everybody wanted to learn how to count cards. You know, and it wasn't this thing that only geniuses could do. It was like, hey, if you have, you know, a good amount of focus, you can learn how to do this. And I'm sure that they hated that. And I guess I'd rather err on the side of you know, being really strict than being seen as wavering on it, which I think is silly, but that's what they're going to do, I guess.
You know, I think another part of it is that there's no real way to demonstrate that you're doing your job if you're a pit boss, right?
Sure.
There's nothing you can really do to show that you're doing a good job.
Anything bad happens today? No. Well, then you're doing your job. Like, if nothing bad happened, then you're doing your job fine. You know, if nobody grabs chips and runs away from runs out the door, you know, then you're doing your job fine, I guess. So yeah, it's a good point. I guess you got to do something to show that you're worth your paycheck.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's how a lot of them think anyway. And the other thing is, you know, no pit boss ever lost his job for throwing somebody out that was a losing player.
Right.
Right? But they have lost their job for letting an advantage player win too much money.
Right.
It's in their best interest to just have no action in their pit at all. They would like every player to come buy in for $100 and bet nickels.
Sure, and I do think that, and I'm not sure if this is every pit boss. I don't want to make a generalization, but I think with some of the ones, at least that I saw while I was playing, there was a bit of like macho kind of not wanting to get taken, you know, by an advantage player. So I think there was a bit of that too. That when they realized that was going on, they would really want to kind of assert their authority. which, you know, fine, whatever. But it's kind of a weird thing. Maybe it's a mixture of all those things. But people definitely, they did not react nicely when they would catch you, you know, counting cards in a casino, for the most part. The ones that did, I always appreciated, though. I got backed off once playing. I was playing at the Aladdin. And I got backed off from the high limit pit. And I was up a bit of money, like, you know, a few thousand here and there. And the guy came over to me and he goes, look, you're much too strong a force to play here. And I really appreciated that because it's a compliment. It's a nice way to do it. It's like, look, they know what's going on. I know that they know. I'm going to leave. It's all peaceful. It's all fine. So I can really appreciate that kind of reaction more than this, like, mad scrambling to make it look like you're doing a drug bust, which is what it often looked like.
Yeah.
We received an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. It was addressed to Richard, but it's a blackjack question. So after Richard says his piece, I'm going to ask the same question to Spencer. It seems this player has just mastered the KO system, and he heard Richard say not so long ago that he would advise his own son, Richard's son, not to count cards in a casino. So the guy says he just learned how to count cards, and so why is Richard telling him not to count cards?
Yeah, why, Richard?
Well, first of all, I have to say my son is kind of in a special situation because he's my son. So here's the thing. It depends on your situation. If you're interested in counting cards as an intellectual hobby and maybe you'll make a little bit of money, that's fine. But my son is trying to make a living gambling, and counting cards has about the lowest edge you can get from professional gambling and the most amount of heat.
Right.
And there is tremendous value in having a clean name. So just let me give you one example. Let's say that you found a biased roulette wheel, right? And
sure.
And you've recorded thousands and thousands of spins, and you know that this wheel is biased, right? Well, if you go in and you have a completely clean name, depending on what the casino is, it's worth six figures, and in some casinos, it would be worth seven figures to find
sure.
that roulette wheel.
Absolutely.
But if you go in and once you start winning, let's say you get up $100,000, every casino is going to say, well, who is this guy? And they're going to start looking. And now they find you in Griffin or Biometrica or whatever, and they say, oh, known card counter? Boom, you're gone. You're barred from that game. So there's tremendous value in having a clean name, and that's why I told my son not to count cards.
You know, I understand that. I actually think it's interesting. I think that like you said, it's a special situation. If somebody's trying to make a lifelong career out of being a professional gambler, then yes, I understand you telling him that adds a level of heat that is, you know, extremely hot. But, you know, it's very different for somebody like myself, that for me, I just love the game of blackjack and I wanted to play that. And I learned to love poker too, and I really did like it, you know, and I enjoyed playing it. But nothing made me feel the rush that I felt while playing blackjack. And, you know, I've opened for bands like The Who, I played with Depeche Mode, I played with the Pixies, I played with the Cramps, I played for crowds of 55,000 people and anything up to that. But I still, like, hold playing on that blackjack team as one of the biggest thrills of my life. And so, I understand not wanting to kind of sully your record if you're going to be doing other things, but if somebody just wanted to be a card counter, I would definitely say that it's worth putting the time in and going to do it. But in, like, your son's case, I do understand why you would advise against it.
We're now going to take a short break for commercials.
Okay.
When we come back, we're going to be asking Spencer a few questions about his rock and roll career, and we're going to include at the end of our show his newest release called Tunica, which is about playing blackjack, and we're going to ask him about that, so stay tuned.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In January, from Sundays through Wednesdays, 3 a.m. to 3 a.m. casino day, the $500,000 spin-to-win promotion is in effect. 500 points earned on a slot machine or 2,000 points earned on a video poker machine earned you one spin. You may spin up to four times a day. Been talking about this all month. As of the time of this recording, the promotion has three more days to run. Beginning February 1st, there will be a Money Madness jackpots going at all times. The major jackpot starts at $10,000 and must be hit by $25,000. All players playing with a card on any machine are eligible to win. If you're playing when the jackpot goes off and you're not the lucky one who hit it, you get $25 in free play. A smaller jackpot begins at $1,000 and must be hit before $2,500. It is expected to be hit about three times a day. There will be double points on all video poker machines on President's Day, Monday, February 20th, midnight to midnight, no limits. The second class in the current 10-week semester of free video poker classes will be on Wednesday, February 1st at noon in the Summer Lounge. This lounge is in front of Don Vito's Italian restaurant. The early class will be beginner double bonus. Second class, beginning at about 2 p.m., will be beginner double-double bonus. The pay schedules offered in these games at the South Point are for the 99% variety, which is tighter than strong players play. Still, the principles of these games is useful for understanding the later classes. Plus, these two games are played very differently from each other because of the different payouts for flushes and straights. The general way these games are played should be in the repertoire of every strong player. At videopoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. Game of the week is Ultimate X. This is a 10 coin per line game where every scoring hand this time earns bonuses next time. Has become one of the most popular formats in video poker. This semester in the video poker classes at the South Point, on March 1st, I will be teaching 8-6 Bonus Poker Deluxe Ultimate X. This is a 99.7% game.
Okay, we're back. We're talking to Spencer Robinson. Now, he played base for the Lords of Altamont. Now, for those of you who don't remember the rock and roll history, Altamont Speedway in Northern California, 45 miles east of San Francisco, in 1969, which is a few months after Woodstock, they held this huge free concert in Altamont, headlined by Rolling Stones, Jefferson Airplane, Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young, others, Grateful Dead, although they never got on.
Right.
They had security from a Hell's Angels biker gang, who apparently were paid off in $500 worth of beer. It seems like these Hell's Angels were seriously bad dudes who took their job seriously. Four people died. Many others got injured. It kind of took some of the shine off of the Altamont concert. And so your group, Lords of Altamont, when it founded in 1999, 30 years after Altamont, apparently took that name as in remembrance of that concert.
Well, so, you know, and I wasn't a founding member of the band. I came in the band after their first record. But basically, and not to be totally music geeky for a second, but that Altamont, that concert, that was the end of the Hippie Love generation. I mean, you know, there was some spillover musically, but really that was like Woodstock had been such a peace and love experience, and this was the polar opposite. And if you've seen the movie Gimme Shelter, which is a documentary about that concert, it really, when you watch it, it doesn't look like peace and love at all. It's really kind of scary. And the band that I played in, the Lords of Altamont, they were really kind of that next phase of music that came out of places like Detroit, bands like the MC5 and the Stooges that were a little more angry, and they kind of let those bands kind of led the way into what became punk rock. So the band was kind of referencing that change and going from kind of the peace and love generation to more of like the leather and kind of anger generation that became those early 70s pre-punk or proto-punk bands. And the guys in the band, a couple of them were bikers themselves, so they adopted the look and the kind of attitude of some of those 60s biker movies like Wild Angels and things like that, and put it on stage. And we kind of had this really tough image, and we played really tough, fast, hard music, and it was just rock and roll and really kind of crazy.
Did you have, as part of your band, did you ever get to meet any real Hell's Angels?
All the time, actually, yeah. They, you know, and I didn't get a chance to talk to a lot of them, but they'd come to the shows, and for the most part, everyone was pretty cool. You know, there was a little bit of, you know, tension here and there in some places, which, you know, happens, but for the most part, everyone was pretty cool. We did go back to the Hell's Angels clubhouse one night in the south of France. We were on tour there, and one of the guys had come to a couple of the shows, and he's like, look, you're coming back to the clubhouse with us. And we said, okay, and I don't think we had to go, but I think we had to go, if you know what I mean. They really wanted to go back there and party with them, which was fine. And, you know, it was a long night. We went back there, and they woke up a couple of their prospects, which are the guys that are trying to get into the club, to have them serve us drinks. And the guy in this biker gang played us a record of his band, and we pretended to like it, and did like that whole thing, and made sure not to look at any of their women, and the whole thing, and it was fine. And we were there for a few hours drinking, and it was all a very kind of fun experience for the most part. And for me, it was kind of funny because the clubhouse looked like, if you're gonna make a movie about a bike club, that's how you'd make the clubhouse look. Like, it had all the things you'd expect it to have. You know, the pool tables and the pictures of the old gangs and, like, a motorcycle helmet, all the things that you'd put there if you were, like, a prop guy for a movie. They were all there. And the thing that I thought was so crazy, though, is that when we left after being served all these drinks and pretending to like the guy's band, his terrible punk rock band and all that stuff, they actually charged us for the drinks that we drank when we left. And we ended up having to pay a few hundred euro in all the drinks, which was a drag, because that's one of those things that we didn't know was going to happen. And, you're a working band on the road, you're not making a lot of money. So, but it was fine. They were pretty cool for the most part. And, a lot of bikers came to our shows and everyone was pretty cool. And I just think that people like rock and roll. And whether you're a biker or whether you're, a suburban kid, if you like rock and roll, you like rock and roll. And we had some really great shows on the road in Europe.
Yeah, I can't imagine you telling the Hell's Angels, no, you're not going to pay the 100 euro. Just don't see that happening.
Oh, no, we paid. We paid very quickly. it was fine.
So now you're on a solo career, I guess you call it.
Yeah, I'd been in that band for a long time, and I left the band, and I was, just doing my thing, and I started writing a lot of songs of my own, and I was really trying to figure out what I wanted to do musically, because I like a lot of different kinds of music, and like, what do I want to do? I don't want to do something that's the same as the Lords, because I did that already. I did 5 years in that band, and I played some great shows, and I recorded some records, and it was really cool. And, I've gotten into bands, people like Tom Waits, people like Nick Cave, things that are a little bit kind of, a little bit more, like, weird, experimental, a little bit about some of the kind of darker things in life. And I just started writing songs about that kind of stuff. And actually, I recorded an EP, which is, it's six songs, or five or six songs, that length of a release. So I recorded five songs. And I putting it out on a small label in Wales that a friend of mine hooked me up with. And they're putting out like a physical product. But it's already online to download now, and people are downloading it and seeming to like it, which is cool. And actually one of the first songs that I wrote, actually the first song that I wrote for the release was about gambling in Mississippi. That's one of the first things that I wanted to write about because it meant so much to me and it was such an important part of my life. And I didn't really have a way to express it because I don't write books or anything like that. So I wrote a song called Tunica, which you guys mentioned before, that's about playing in the South and about the first time that I went to the South to play blackjack.
So the song, which we're going to hear shortly, it does mention going to the seashore where the ships never leave the shore.
Right.
and it does mention a few other things related to gambling, but to me it seemed there were relatively few mentions of the actual blackjack experience. If I didn't know that was about blackjack, I would not have gotten that from the song.
Which I think that's kind of the point. No, I think that's the point. The stuff that I write is not super literal. I mean, it's not like so abstract that it doesn't make sense. But you know, I like songs that are open to interpretation. That's what I've always liked about music, is that, you know, a song really means different things to different people. And when I was growing up, all of my most important memories generally have some kind of a song or a band or something associated with them. Like when I used to go play sessions on the team, I listened to the Rolling Stones every time before I walked in. That was just a thing that I did. For me, it was like a getting pumped up, getting my mind in the right state. That, you know, so for me, there was always like a connection to songs, and I like that they mean different things to different people. And for me, like, there's a lot of references to the South in that song, and there's a few references to blackjack, and there's some that maybe not everybody would get because they're just specific to that one time that I went or whatever it was. But for me, it's representative of going to the South for the first time ever in my life, because I hadn't even played shows in the South or anything yet, and just going there and experiencing it, what it was like to be there as a blackjack player and not as like a tourist or as anything else.
Very good. So we are going to close the show today with that song. And so we want to thank you, Spencer Robinson.
Thanks, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
I'm assuming that people who want to get your stuff can do it on iTunes and places like that.
Yeah, it's available on iTunes, Amazon, Tidal, all the regular spots.
Very good. So thank you, Spencer. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody, as we listen to the song from Spencer Robinson.
Thanks, guys.
Myself in Tennessee.